Goodbye, Sully. We'll meet again. And with that, Jonathan held in thought an image of the great gulf locks on the shore of another time, and he knew with practiced ease that he was not bone and feather, but a perfect idea of freedom and flight, limited by nothing at all. Fletcher Lynn Seagull was still quite young, but already he knew that no bird had ever been so harshly treated by any flock, or with so much injustice. "I don't care what they say," he thought fiercely, and his vision blurred as he flew out toward the far cliffs. "There's so much more to flying than just flapping around from place to place. A mosquito does that. One little barrel roll around the Elder Gull just for fun, and I'm outcast? Are they blind? Can't they see? Can't they think of the glory that it'll be when we really learn to fly? I don't care what they think. I'll show them what flying is. I'll be pure outlaw, if that's the way they want it. And I'll make them so sorry." The voice came inside his own head, and though it was very gentle, it startled him so much that he faltered and stumbled in the air. "Don't be harsh on them, Fletcher Seagull. In casting you out, the other gulls have only hurt themselves. And one day they will know this, and one day they will see what you see. Forgive them, and help them to understand." An inch from his right wingtip flew the most brilliant white gull in all the world, gliding effortlessly along, not moving a feather, at what was very nearly Fletcher's top speed. There was a moment of chaos in the young bird. "What's going on? Am I mad? Am I dead? What is this?" Low and calm, the voice went on within his thought, demanding an answer. "Fletcher Lynn Seagull, do you want to fly?"
"Yes, I want to fly."
"Fletcher Lynn Seagull, do you want to fly so much that you will forgive the flock and learn and go back to them one day and work to help them know?" There was no lying to this magnificent, skillful being, no matter how proud or how hurt a bird was Fletcher Seagull. "I do," he said softly. "Then Fletch," that bright creature said to him, and the voice was very kind, "let's begin with level flight." Part 3. Jonathan circled slowly over the far cliffs, watching. This rough young Fletcher Gull was very nearly a perfect flight student. He was strong and light and quick in the air, but far and away more important, he had a blazing drive to learn to fly. Here he came this minute, a blurred gray shape roaring out of a dive, flashing 150 miles per hour past his instructor. He pulled abruptly into another try at a 16-point vertical slow roll, calling the points out loud.
8, 9, 10. See, Jonathan, I'm running out of airspeed. 11. I want good sharp stuff like yours. 12. But blast it, I just can't make it. 13. These last 3 points without 14.
Fletcher's whipstall at the top was all the worse for his rage and fury at failing. He fell backward, tumbled, slammed savagely into an inverted spin, and recovered at last, panting, 100 feet below his instructor's level.
You're wasting your time with me, Jonathan. I'm too dumb. I'm too stupid. I try and I try, but I'll never get it.
Jonathan Siegel looked down at him and nodded. You'll certainly never get it as long as you make that pull up so hard. Fletcher, you lost 40 miles an hour in the entry. You have to be smooth. Firm but smooth, remember? He dropped down to the level of the younger gull. Let's try it together now, in formation. And pay attention to that pull-up. It's a smooth, easy entry. By the end of 3 months, Jonathan had 6 other students, outcasts all, yet curious about the strange new idea of flight for the joy of flying. Still, it was easier for them to practice high performance than it was to understand the reason behind it. Each of us is, in truth, an idea of the great gull, an unlimited idea of freedom, Jonathan would say in the evenings on the beach. And precision flying is a step toward expressing our real nature. Everything that limits us, we have to put aside. That's why all this high-speed practice and low-speed and aerobatics, and his students would be asleep, exhausted from the day's flying. They liked the practice because it was fast and exciting, and it fed a hunger for learning that grew with every lesson. But not one of them, not even Fletcher Lind Gull, had come to believe that the flight of ideas could possibly be as real as the flight of wind and feather. Your whole body, from wingtip to wingtip, Jonathan would say other times, is nothing more than your thought itself, in a form you can see. Break the chains of your thought, and you break the chains of your body, too. But no matter how he said it, it sounded like pleasant fiction, and they needed more to sleep. It was only a month later that Jonathan said the time had come to return to the flock. We're not ready, said Henry Calvin Gull. We're not welcome. We're outcast. We can't force ourselves to go where we're not welcome, can we? We're free to go where we wish and to be what we are, Jonathan answered. And he lifted from the sand and turned east toward the home grounds of the flock. There was brief anguish among his students, for it is the law of the flock that an outcast never returns, and the law had not been broken once in 10,000 years. The law said stay, Jonathan said go. And by now he was a mile across the water. If they waited much longer, he would reach a hostile flock alone. Well, we don't have to obey the law if we're not a part of the flock, do we? Fletcher said, rather self-consciously. Besides, if there's a fight, we'll be a lot more help there than here. And so they flew in from the west that morning, 8 of them in a double diamond formation, wingtips almost overlapping. They came across the flock's council beach at 135 miles per hour, Jonathan in the lead, Fletcher smoothly at his right, Henry Calvin struggling gamely at his left. Then the whole formation rolled slowly to the right as one bird, level, two, inverted, two, level, the wind whipping over them all. The squawks and grockles of everyday life in the flock were cut off as though the formation were a giant knife, and 8,000 gull eyes watched without a single blink. One by one, each of the 8 birds pulled sharply upward into a full loop and flew all the way around to a dead slow stand-up landing on the sand. Then, as though this sort of thing happened every day, Jonathan Siegel began his critique of the flight. To begin with, he said with a wry smile, you were all a bit late on the join-up. It went like lightning through the flock. Those birds are outcast, and they have returned, and that can't happen. Fletcher's predictions of battle melted in the flock's confusion. Well, okay, they may be outcast, said some of the younger gulls, but where on earth did they learn to fly like that? It took almost an hour for the word of the elder to pass through the flock. Ignore them. The gull who speaks to an outcast is himself an outcast. The gull who looks upon an outcast breaks the law of the flock. Gray-feathered backs were turned upon Jonathan from that moment onward. But he didn't appear to notice. He held his practice sessions directly over the council beach, and for the first time, began pressing his students to the limit of their ability.
"Martin Gull," he shouted across the sky, "you say you know low-speed flying? You know nothing till you prove it. Fly!"
So quiet little Martin William Seagull, startled to be caught under his instructor's fire, surprised himself and became a wizard of low speeds. In the lightest breeze, he could curve his feathers to lift himself without a single flap of wing, from sand to cloud and down again. Likewise, Charles Roland Gull flew the Great Mountain Wind to 24,000 feet, came down blue from the cold, thin air, amazed and happy, determined to go still higher tomorrow. Fletcher Seagull, who loved aerobatics like no one else, conquered his 16-point vertical slow roll, and the next day topped it off with a triple cartwheel, his feathers flashing white sunlight to a beach from which more than one furtive eye watched. Every hour, Jonathan was there at the side of each of his students, demonstrating, suggesting, pressuring, guiding. He flew with them through night and cloud and storm for the sport of it, while the flock huddled miserably on the ground. When the flying was done, the students relaxed on the sand, and in time they listened more closely to Jonathan. He had some crazy ideas that they couldn't understand, but then he had some good ones that they could. Gradually, in the night, another circle formed around the circle of students, a circle of curious gulls listening in the darkness for hours on end, not wishing to see or be seen of one another, fading away before daybreak. It was a month after the return that the first gull of the flock crossed the line and asked to learn how to fly. In his asking, Terence Lowell Gull became a condemned bird, labeled outcast, and the eighth of Jonathan's students. The next night from the flock came Kirk Maynard Gull, wobbling across the sand, dragging his left wing to collapse at Jonathan's feet. "Help me," he said very quietly, speaking in the way that the dying speak. "I want to fly more than anything else in the world." "Come along then," said Jonathan. "Climb with me away from the ground, and we'll begin." "You don't understand. My wing, I can't move my wing." "Maynard Gull, you have the freedom to be yourself, your true self, here and now, and nothing can stand in your way. It is the law of the great gull, the law that is."
"Are you saying I can fly?"
"I say you are free." As simply and as quickly as that, Kirk Maynard Gull spread his wings, effortlessly, and lifted into the dark night air. The flock was roused from sleep by his cry, as loud as he could scream it, from 500 feet up.
"I can fly! Listen! I can fly!"
By sunrise, there were nearly 1,000 birds standing outside the circle of students, looking curiously at Maynard. They didn't care whether they were seen or not, and they listened, trying to understand Jonathan Seagull. He spoke of very simple things, that it is right for a gull to fly, that freedom is the very nature of his being, that whatever stands against that freedom must be set aside, be it ritual or superstition or limitation in any form. "Set aside," came a voice from the multitude, "even if it be the law of the flock?" "The only true law is that which leads to freedom," Jonathan said. "There is no other." "How do you expect us to fly as you fly?" came another voice. "You are special and gifted and divine, above other birds." Look at Fletcher, Lowell, Charles Rowland. Are they also special and gifted and divine? No more than you are, no more than I am. The only difference, the very only one, is that they have begun to understand what they really are and have begun to practice it. His students, save Fletcher, shifted uneasily. They hadn't realized that this was what they were doing. The crowd grew larger every day, coming to question, to idolize, to scorn. "They are saying in the flock that if you are not the son of the great Gull himself," Fletcher told Jonathan one morning after advanced speed practice, "then you are 1,000 years ahead of your time." Jonathan sighed. The price of being misunderstood, he thought. They call you devil or they call you God. What do you think, Fletch? Are we ahead of our time? A long silence. Well, this kind of flying has always been here to be learned by anybody who wanted to discover it. That's got nothing to do with time. We're ahead of the fashion, maybe, ahead of the way that most gulls fly. That's something, Jonathan said, rolling to glide inverted for a while. That's not half as bad as being ahead of our time. It happened just a week later. Fletcher was demonstrating the elements of high-speed flying to a class of new students. He had just pulled out of his dive from 7,000 feet, a long gray streak firing a few inches above the beach, when a young bird, on its first flight, glided directly into his path, calling for its mother. With a tenth of a second to avoid the youngster, Fletcher Lynn Seagull snapped hard to the left at something over 200 miles per hour into a cliff of solid granite. It was for him as though the rock were a giant hard door into another world, a burst of fear and shock and black as he hit. And then he was adrift in a strange, strange sky, forgetting, remembering, forgetting, afraid and sad and sorry, terribly sorry. The voice came to him as it had in the first day that he had met Jonathan Livingston Seagull. "The trick, Fletcher, is that we are trying to overcome our limitations in order, patiently. We don't tackle flying through rock until a little later in the program." "Jonathan, also known as the son of the great gull," his instructor said dryly. "What are you doing here? The cliff. Didn't I die? "Oh, Fletch, come on, think. If you were talking to me now, then obviously you didn't die, did you? What you did manage to do was to change your level of consciousness rather abruptly. It's your choice now. You can stay here and learn on this level, which is quite a bit higher than the one you left, by the way. Or you can go back and keep working with the flock." The elders were hoping for some kind of disaster, but they're startled that you obliged them so well. "I want to go back to the flock, of course. I've barely begun with the new group." "Very well, Fletcher. Remember what we were saying about one's body being nothing more than thought itself." Fletcher shook his head and stretched his wings and opened his eyes at the base of the cliff in the center of the whole flock assembled. There was a great clamor of squawks and screes from the crowd when he first moved. "He lives! He that was dead lives! Touched him with a wingtip, brought him to life, the son of the great gull! No, he denies it. He's a devil, devil, come to break the flock." There were 4,000 gulls in the crowd, frightened at what had happened. And the cry "devil" went through them like the wind of an ocean storm. Eyes glazed, beaks sharp. They closed in to destroy. "Would you feel better if we left, Fletcher?" asked Jonathan. "I certainly wouldn't object too much if we did." Instantly, they stood together, a half mile away, and the flashing beaks of the mob closed on empty air. "Why is it," Jonathan puzzled, "that the hardest thing in the world is to convince a bird that he is free, and that he can prove it for himself if he just spent a little time practicing? Why should that be so hard? Fletcher still blinked from the change of scene. What did you just do? How did we get here? You did say you wanted to be out of the mob, didn't you? Yes, but how did you... Like everything else, Fletcher. Practice. By morning, the flock had forgotten its insanity, but Fletcher had not. Jonathan, remember what you said a long time ago about loving the flock enough to return to it and help it learn? Yes. I don't understand how you managed to love a mob of birds that has just tried to kill you. Oh, Fletch, you don't love that. You don't love hatred and evil, of course. You have to practice and see the real gull, the good in every one of them, and to help them see it in themselves. That's what I mean by love. It's fun when you get the knack of it. I remember a fierce young bird, for instance, Fletcher Lind Seagull, his name. Just been made outcast, ready to fight the flock to the death, getting a start on building his own bitter hell out on the far cliffs. And here he is today, building his own heaven instead, and leading the whole flock in that direction. Fletcher turned to his instructor, and there was a moment of fright in his eye. Me leading? What do you mean, me leading? You're the instructor here. You couldn't leave. Couldn't I? Don't you think that there might be other flocks, other Fletchers, that need an instructor more than this one, that's on its way toward the light? Me? John, I'm just a plain seagull, and you're the only son of the great gull, I suppose. Jonathan sighed and looked out to sea. You don't need me any longer. You need to keep finding yourself. A little more each day, that real, unlimited Fletcher Seagull. He's your instructor. You need to understand him and to practice him. A moment later, Jonathan's body wavered in the air, shimmering, and began to go transparent. Don't let them spread silly rumors about me or make me a god, okay, Fletch? I'm a seagull. I like to fly. Maybe... Jonathan! Poor Fletch, don't believe what your eyes are telling you. All they show is limitation. Look with your understanding. Find out what you already know, and you'll see the way to fly. The shimmering stopped. Jonathan Seagull had vanished into empty air. After a time, Fletcher Gull dragged himself into the sky and faced a brand new group of students, eager for their first lesson. To begin with, he said heavily, you've got to understand that a seagull is an unlimited idea of freedom, an image of the great gull, and your whole body from wingtip to wingtip is nothing more than your thought itself. The young gulls looked at him quizzically. Come on, they thought. This doesn't sound like a rule for a loop. Fletcher sighed and started over. Very well, he said and eyed them critically. Let's begin with level flight. And saying that, he understood all at once that his friend had quite honestly been no more divine than Fletcher himself. No limits, Jonathan? He thought. Well, then the time's not distant when I'm going to appear out of thin air on your beach and show you a thing or two about flying. And though he tried to look properly severe for his students, Fletcher Seagull suddenly saw them all as they really were, just for a moment. And he more than liked, he loved what it was he saw. No limits, Jonathan, he thought, and he smiled. His race to learn had begun. Part 4. For a few years after Jonathan Seagull vanished from the beaches of the flock, it was the strangest bunch of birds that had ever lived on Earth. Many of them had actually begun to understand the message he had brought. And it was as common to see a young gull flying upside down and practicing loops as it was to see an old one unwilling to open his eyes to the glory of flying, boring straight and level out to the fishing boats, hoping for a supper of soggy bread. Fletcher Lynn Seagull and the other students of Jonathan spread their instructor's teaching of freedom and flight in long missionary journeys to every flock on the coastline. There were remarkable events in those days. Fletcher's own students and students of their students were flying with precision and a kind of joy that had never been seen before. Here and there were individual birds who flew aerobatics as they practiced better than Fletcher, sometimes better even than Jonathan himself had flown them. The learning curve of a highly motivated seagull goes on steeply off the top of any graph, and now and then there were students who overcame limits so perfectly that they disappeared, as Jonathan had, from the face of an earth too limited to contain them. It was a golden age for a while. Crowds of gulls elbowed in upon Fletcher to touch the one who had touched Jonathan Seagull, a bird they now considered divine. In vain did Fletcher insist that Jonathan had been a gull like them all, who had learned as they all could learn. They were after him constantly to hear Jonathan's exact words, his precise gestures, to find tiny details about him. The more they begged for trivia, the more uneasy grew Fletcher Gull. When once they had been interested in practicing the message, training and flying fast and free and glorious in the sky, now they began to slack away from difficult work and became ever so slightly wild-eyed over legends of Jonathan, as though he were the idol of a fan club. "Gull Fletcher," they asked, "did the magnificent Jonathan say, 'We are in truth the ideas of the great gull,' or was it, 'We are in fact the ideas of the great gull?" "Please, call me Fletcher, just Fletcher Seagull," he would reply, appalled that they would use a term of reverence upon him. "And what difference does it make which word he used? Both are correct. Both are ideas of the great gull." But he knew they were not satisfied with his answer. They thought he had dodged their question. "Gull Fletcher, when the divine gull Jonathan rose to fly, did he move one step toward the wind or two?" Before he could correct the one question, another was fired. "Gull Fletcher, did the sacred gull Jonathan have gray eyes or golden eyes?" The questioner, a bird with gray eyes, was in anguish for one answer only. "I don't know. Forget his eyes. He had purple eyes. How can that matter? What he came to tell us was that we can fly. If we would just wake up and stop standing around on the beach talking about the color of somebody's eyes. Now watch, and I'll show you a pinwheel turn." But more than one gull, finding it wearying to practice something as difficult as a pinwheel, flew home musing, "The great one had purple eyes, not like my eyes, not like the eyes of any gull that ever lived." The classes changed with years, from wide soaring poems in flight to hushed talk about Jonathan before and after practice, to long involved recitations on the sand about the Divine One with no flying ever done by anybody. Fletcher and the other students of Jonathan were at turns puzzled and correctful and firm and furious at the change, but they were helpless to stop it. They were honored and, worse, revered, but they were no longer heard, and the birds who practiced flying were fewer and fewer. One by one, the original students passed away, leaving cold, dead bodies behind them. The flock, seizing upon the bodies, held great tearful ceremonies over them, burying them under enormous cairns of pebbles, each pebble laid in place with a long, sorrowing sermon by a deadly, solemn bird. The cairns became shrines, and it was required ritual for every gull who wished oneness to drop a pebble and a doleful speech upon the cairn. No one knew what oneness was, but it was such a serious, deep thing that a gull could never ask without being thought a fool. Why, everybody knows what oneness is, and the prettier the pebble you drop on Gull Martin's tomb, the better your chance of getting there. Fletcher passed away last of all. It happened during a long, lonely session of the purest and most beautiful flying he had ever done. His body vanished in the midst of a long, vertical, slow roll, something he had practiced since he first met Jonathan Seagull. And when he vanished, he was not setting pebbles or meditating over slogans of oneness. He was lost in the perfection of his own flight. When Fletcher didn't show up on the beach in the next week, when he vanished without leaving a note, the flock was in brief consternation. But then they gathered together and thought and decided what must have happened. It was announced that Gull Fletcher had been seen surrounded by the other 7 first students, standing on what would henceforth be known as the Rock of Oneness. And then the clouds had parted, and the great gull, Jonathan Livingston Seagull himself, clad in royal plumes and golden shells, with a crown of precious pebbles upon his brow, pointing symbolically to sky and sea and wind and earth, had called him up to the beach of oneness, and Fletcher had magically risen, surrounded by holy rays, and the clouds had closed again over the scene to a great chorus of gull voices singing. And so the pile of pebbles on the Rock of Oneness in sacred memory of Gull Fletcher was the biggest pile of pebbles on any coastline anywhere on Earth. Other piles were built everywhere in replica, and each Tuesday afternoon the flock walked over to stand around the pebbles and hear the miracles of Jonathan Livingston Seagull and his gifted divine students. Nobody did any more flying than was absolutely necessary, and when it was necessary, they grew strange customs about it. As a kind of status symbol, the more affluent birds began carrying branches from trees in their beaks. The larger and heavier the branch a gull carried, the more attention he earned in the flock. The larger the branch, the more progressive a flyer he was considered. A few in gull society noticed that by carrying the weight and drag of the branches around with them, the most faithful seagulls became disturbing flyers. The symbol for Jonathan's teaching became a smooth pebble. Then later, any old rock would do. It was the worst possible symbol for a bird who had come to teach the joy of flight, but nobody seemed to notice. At least, nobody who mattered in the flock. On Tuesdays, all flying stopped, and the listless crowd gathered to stand and hear the official flock student recite. In a matter of only a few years, the recitations stratified and hardened into granite dogma. Ho, Jonathak, Gullak, great Gullak, Wanak, have pity on we who are lower than sand fleas. On and on for hours come Tuesday. It was a mark of excellence for the official to run the sounds together rapid fire so they couldn't be recognized as words at all.
Oh, Jonathan, God, great God, God, pity on the earth, lower than sand flea.
A few insolent birds whispered that the sound meant nothing anyway. Even if one could eventually figure out that there was in fact a word or two buried within it. Images of Jonathan, pecked from sandstone set with great, sad, purple-shell eyes, sprung up all along the coastline at every cairn and replica cairn, centers to a worship heavier even than rocks could symbolize. In less than 200 years, nearly every element of Jonathan's teaching was taken out of daily practice by the simple pronouncement that it was holy and beyond the aspiration of common gulls lower than sand fleas. In time, the rites and ceremonies that were planted around the name of Jonathan Seagull became obsessive. Any thinking gull altered course in the air so as not to even fly in sight of the cairns. Built as they were on the ceremony and superstition of those who preferred excuses for failure instead of hard work and greatness. The thinking gulls paradoxically closed their minds at the sound of certain words. Flight, cairn, great gull, Jonathan. On all other matters, they were the most lucid, honest birds since Jonathan himself. But at the mention of his name, or any of the other terms so badly mauled by the official local students, their minds snapped shut, with the sound of trap doors closing. Because they were curious, they began experimenting with flight, though they never used that word. It's not flight, they'd assured themselves over and again. It's just a way of finding what's true. So, in rejecting the students, they became students themselves. In rejecting the name of Jonathan Seagull, they practiced the message he had brought to the flock. This was no noisy revolution. There was no shouting, no waving of banners. But individuals like Anthony Seagull, for instance, not fully grown into the feathers of adulthood, began asking questions. "Now look," he had told his official local student, "the birds who come to hear you every Tuesday come for three reasons, don't they? Because they think they're learning something, because they think that putting another pebble on the cairn is going to make them holy, or because everybody else expects them to be there, right?" "And you have nothing to learn, my nestling?" "No, there's something to learn, but I don't know what it is. A million pebbles can't make me holy if I don't deserve it, and I don't care what the other gulls think about me."
"And what is your answer, nestling?" Ever so slightly shaken by this heresy. "How do you call the miracle of life? The great gull Jonathan, holy be his name, said that flight..."
"Life isn't a miracle. Official, it's a bore. Your great gull Jonathan is a myth, somebody made up a long time ago, a fairy tale that the weak believe because they can't stand to face the world as it is. Imagine a seagull who could fly 200 miles per hour. I've tried it. And the fastest I can go is 50, diving, and even then I'm mostly out of control. There are laws of flight that cannot be broken. If you don't think so, you go out there and try it. Do you honestly believe truly now that your great Jonathan Seagull flew 200 miles per hour?"
"And faster," the official said in perfect blind faith, "and taught others to do so."
"So goes your fairy tale. But when you can show me that you can fly that fast, official, then I'll begin listening to what you have to say." There was the key, and Anthony Seagull knew it the instant he said the words. He didn't have answers, but he knew that he would gratefully, gladly lay down his life to follow any bird who could demonstrate what he was talking about, show him just a few answers in life that worked, that brought excellence and joy into everyday living. Until he found that bird, life would remain gray and bleak, illogical, without purpose. Every seagull would remain a coincidental collection of blood and feathers pointed toward oblivion. Anthony Seagull went his own way, as did more and more other young birds, rejecting the ritual and ceremony that encrusted the name of Jonathan Seagull. Sad at the futility of life, but at least honest with themselves, brave enough to face the fact that it was futile. Then, one afternoon, Anthony was flapping along above the sea, thinking blankly that life is pointless, and since pointless is by definition meaningless, then the only proper act is to dive down into the ocean and drown. Better not to exist at all than to exist like a seaweed, without meaning or joy. It all made sense. It was pure logic. And Anthony Seagull had all his life tried to abide by honesty and logic. He had to die sooner or later anyway, and he saw no reason to prolong the painful boredom of living. So he pushed over from 2,000 feet into a dive straight toward the water, coming down at nearly 50 miles per hour. It was oddly exhilarating to have made the decision at last,
He had found the one answer that made any sense at all. Along about midway into his death dive, with the sea tilting and growing huge beneath him, there was a great whistling roar directly past his right wing, and he was passed in flight by another seagull. Passed as though he had been standing on the beach. The other bird was a white streak blazing down, a blurred meteor from space. Anthony, startled, bent his wings into dive breaks and wondered helplessly at the sight. The blur dwindled softly toward the sea, flashing down at the wave tops, and then bent into a hard pull-up, break-pointing right straight back up into the sky, and rolled. A long, vertical, slow roll, twisting off into an impossible full circle in the air. Anthony stalled, watching. Forgot where he was, stalled again. "I swear," he said out loud, "I swear that was a seagull." He turned at once toward the other bird, who apparently hadn't noticed him. "Hey!" he called as loud as he could. "Hey! Wait up!" The gull pitched immediately up on one wing, moving at tremendous speed, blazed back toward him. Anthony, in level flight, pulled hard into a vertical bank and stopped suddenly in the air, as a racing skier stops at the end of a downhill run. "Hey!" Anthony was all out of breath. What are you doing?" It was a silly question, but he didn't know what else to say. "I'm sorry if I startled you," the stranger said in a voice as clear and friendly as the wind. "I had you in sight all the time, just playing. I wouldn't have hit you." "No, no, that's not it." Anthony was awake and alive for the first time in his life, inspired. "What was that?" "Oh, some fun flying, I guess. A dive and a pull-up to a slow roll with a rolling loop off the top. Just messing around. If you really want to do it well, it takes a bit of practice, but it's a nice-looking thing, don't you think?"
It's beautiful, is what it is. But you haven't been around the flock at all. Who are you, anyway?"
"You can call me John."
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.